I. When Bartley Hubbard went to interview Silas Lapham for the Solid Men of Boston series, which he undertook to finish up in the events, after he replaced their original projector on that newspaper, Lapham received him in his private office by previous appointment. "Walk right in," he called out to the journalist, whom he caught sight of through the door of the counting room. He did not rise from the desk at which he was writing, but he gave Bartley his left hand for welcome, and he rolled his large head in the direction of a vacant chair. "Sit down. I'll be with you in just half a minute." "Take your time," said Bartley, with the ease he instantly felt. "I'm in no hurry." He took a notebook from his pocket, laid it on his knee, and began to sharpen a pencil. "There." Lapham pounded with his great hairy fist on the envelope he had been addressing. "William," he called out, and he handed the letter to a boy who came to get it. "I want that to go right away." "Well, sir," he continued, wheeling round in his leather-cushioned swivel chair, and facing Bartley, seated so near that their knees almost touched, "so you want my life, death, and Christian sufferings, do you, young man?" "That's what I'm after," said Bartley. "Your money or your life." "I guess you wouldn't want my life without the money," said Lapham, as if he were willing to prolong these moments of preparation. "Take 'em both," Bartley suggested. "Don't want your money without your life, if you come to that. But you're just 1 million times more interesting to the public than if you hadn't a dollar, and you know that as well as I do, Mr. Lapham. There's no use beating about the bush." "No," said Lapham, somewhat absently. He put out his huge foot and pushed the ground glass door shut between his little den and the bookkeeper's, in their larger den outside. "In personal appearance," wrote Bartley in the sketch for which he now studied his subject, while he waited patiently for him to continue, "Silas Lapham is a fine type of the successful American. He has a square, bold chin, only partially concealed by the short reddish-gray beard, growing to the edges of his firmly closing lips. His nose is short and straight, his forehead good, but broad rather than high, his eyes blue, and with a light in them that is kindly or sharp according to his mood. He is of medium height, and fills an average armchair with a solid bulk, which on the day of our interview was unpretentiously clad in a business suit of blue serge. His head droops somewhat from a short neck, which does not trouble itself to rise far from a pair of massive shoulders." "I don't know as I know just where you want me to begin," said Lapham.
"Might begin with your birth, that's where most of us begin," replied Bartley. A gleam of humorous appreciation shot into Lapham's blue eyes. "I didn't know whether you wanted me to go quite so far back as that," he said. "But there's no disgrace in having been born, and I was born in the state of Vermont, pretty well up under the Canada line, so well up, in fact, that I came very near being an adoptive citizen, for I was bound to be an American of some sort, from the word go. That was about, well, let me see. Pretty near 60 years ago. This is 75, and that was 20. Well, say I'm 55 years old, and I've lived 'em, too, not an hour of waste time about me, anywheres. I was born on a farm, and worked in the field summers and went to school winters, regulation thing?" Bartley cut in.
"Regulation thing," said Lapham, accepting this irreverent version of his history somewhat dryly.
"Parents poor, of course," suggested the journalist. "Any barefoot business? Early deprivations of any kind, that would encourage the youthful reader to go and do likewise? Orphan myself, you know," said Bartley, with a smile of cynical good camaraderie. Lapham looked at him silently, and then said with quiet self-respect, "I guess if you see these things as a joke, my life won't interest you."
"Oh yes, it will," returned Bartley, unabashed. "You'll see, it'll come out all right." And in fact it did so, in the interview which Bartley printed.
"Mr. Lapham," he wrote, passed rapidly over the story of his early life, its poverty and its hardships, sweetened, however, by the recollections of a devoted mother, and a father who, if somewhat her inferior in education, was no less ambitious for the advancement of his children. They were quiet, unpretentious people, religious, after the fashion of that time, and of sterling morality, and they taught their children the simple virtues of the Old Testament and Poor Richard's Almanac. Bartley could not deny himself this jibe, but he trusted to Lapham's unliterary habit of mind for his security in making it, and most other people would consider it sincere reporter's rhetoric. "You know," he explained to Lapham, "that we have to look at all these facts as material, and we get the habit of classifying them. Sometimes a leading question will draw out a whole line of facts that a man himself would never think of." He went on to put several queries, and it was from Lapham's answers that he generalized the history of his childhood. Mr. Lapham, although he did not dwell on his boyish trials and struggles, spoke of them with deep feeling and an abiding sense of their reality. This was what he added in the interview, and by the time he had got Lapham past the period where risen Americans are all pathetically alike in their narrow circumstances, their sufferings, and their aspirations, he had beguiled him into forgetfulness of the check he had received, and had him talking again in perfect enjoyment of his autobiography. "Yes, sir," said Lapham, in a strain which Bartley was careful not to interrupt again, "a man never sees all that his mother has been to him till it's too late to let her know that he sees it. Why, my mother," he stopped. "It gives me a lump in the throat," he said apologetically, with an attempt at a laugh. Then he went on, "She was a little frail thing, not bigger than a good-sized intermediate schoolgirl, but she did the whole work of a family of boys, and boarded the hired men besides. She cooked, swept, washed, ironed, made and mended from daylight till dark and from dark till daylight, I was going to say, for I don't know how she got any time for sleep. But I suppose she did. She got time to go to church, and to teach us to read the Bible, and to misunderstand it in the old way. She was good. But it ain't her on her knees in church that comes back to me so much like the sight of an angel as her on her knees before me at night, washing my poor, dirty little feet, that I'd run bare in all day, and making me decent for bed. There were six of us boys, it seems to me we were all of a size, and she was just so careful with all of us. I can feel her hands on my feet yet." Bartley looked at Lapham's number 10 boots, and softly whistled through his teeth. "We were patched all over, but we wa'n't ragged. I don't know how she got through it. She didn't seem to think it was anything, and I guess it was no more than my father expected of her. He worked like a horse indoors and out up at daylight, feeding the stock, and groaning round all day with his rheumatism, but not stopping." Bartley hid a yawn over his notebook, and probably, if he could have spoken his mind, he would have suggested to Lapham that he was not there for the purpose of interviewing his ancestry. But Bartley had learned to practice a patience with his victims which he did not always feel, and to feign an interest in their digressions till he could bring them up with a round turn. "I tell you," said Lapham, jabbing the point of his penknife into the writing pad on the desk before him, "when I hear women complaining nowadays that their lives are stunted and empty, I want to tell them about my mother's life. I could paint it out for them." Bartley saw his opportunity at the word paint, and cut in. "And you say, Mr. Lapham, that you discovered this mineral paint on the old farm yourself?" Lapham acquiesced in the return to business. "I didn't discover it," he said scrupulously. "My father found it one day, in a hole made by a tree blowing down. There it was, lying loose in the pit, and sticking to the roots that had pulled up a big cake of dirt with them. I don't know what gave him the idea that there was money in it, but he did think so from the start. I guess, if they'd had the word in those days, they'd considered him pretty much of a crank about it. He was trying as long as he lived to get that paint introduced, but he couldn't make it go. The country was so poor they couldn't paint their houses with anything, and father hadn't any facilities. It got to be a kind of joke with us, and I guess that paint mine did as much as any one thing to make us boys clear out as soon as we got old enough. All my brothers went west, and took up land, but I hung on to New England and I hung on to the old farm, not because the paint mine was on it, but because the old house was in the graves. Well," said Lapham, as if unwilling to give himself too much credit, "there wouldn't been any market for it, anyway. You can go through that part of the state and buy more farms than you can shake a stick at for less money than it cost to build the barns on them. Of course, it's turned out a good thing. I keep the old house up in good shape, and we spend a month or so there every summer. M. wife kind of likes it, and the girls. Pretty place, sightly all round it. I've got a force of men at work there the whole time, and I've got a man and his wife in the house. Had a family meeting there last year, the whole connection from out west. There." Lapham rose from his seat and took down a large warped, unframed photograph from the top of his desk, passing his hand over it, and then blowing vigorously upon it, to clear it of the dust. "There we are, all of us. I don't need to look twice at you," said Bartley, putting his finger on one of the heads. "Well, that's Bill," said Lapham, with a gratified laugh. "He's about as brainy as any of us, I guess. He's one of their leading lawyers, out Dubuque way, been judge of the common pleas once or twice. That's his son just graduated at Yale alongside of my youngest girl. Good-looking chap, ain't he?" "She's a good-looking chap," said Bartley, with prompt irreverence. He hastened to add, at the frown which gathered between Lapham's eyes, "What a beautiful creature she is. What a lovely, refined, sensitive face. And she looks good, too." "She is good," said the father, relenting. "And, after all, that's about the best thing in a woman," said the potential reprobate. "If my wife wasn't good enough to keep both of us straight, I don't know what would become of me. My other daughter, said Lapham, indicating a girl with eyes that showed large, and a face of singular gravity. "Miss Lapham," he continued, touching his wife's effigy with his little finger. "My brother Willard and his family farm at Kankakee. Hazard Lapham and his wife Baptist Preacher in Kansas. Jim and his three girls milling business at Minneapolis. Ben and his family practicing medicine in Fort Wayne." The figures were clustered in an irregular group in front of an old farmhouse, whose original ugliness had been smartened up with a coat of Lapham's own paint, and heightened with an incongruous piazza. The photographer had not been able to conceal the fact that they were all decent, honest-looking, sensible people, with a very fair share of beauty among the young girls. Some of these were extremely pretty, in fact. He had put them into awkward and constrained attitudes, of course, and they all looked as if they had the instrument of torture which photographers call a headrest under their occiputs. Here and there an elderly lady's face was a mere blur, and some of the younger children had twitched themselves into wavering shadows, and might have passed for spirit photographs of their own little ghosts. It was the standard family group photograph, in which most Americans have figured at some time or other, and Lapham exhibited a just satisfaction in it. "I presume," he mused aloud, as he put it back on top of his desk, "that we shan't soon get together again, all of us." "And you say," suggested Bartley, "that you stayed right along on the old place, when the rest cleared out west." "No, oh, said Lapham, with a long, loud drawl, "I cleared out west too, first off. Went to Texas. Texas was all the cry in those days. But I got enough of the Lone Star in about 3 months, and I come back with the idea that Vermont was good enough for me." "Fatted calf business?" queried Bartley, with his pencil poised above his notebook. "I presume they were glad to see me," said Lapham, with dignity. "Mother," he added gently, "died that winter, and I stayed on with father. I buried him in the spring, and then I came down to a little place called Lumberville, and picked up what jobs I could get. I worked round at the sawmills, and I was ostler a while at the hotel. I always did like a good horse. Well, I wa'n't exactly a college graduate, and I went to school odd times. I got to driving the stage after a while, and by I bought the stage and run the business myself. Then I hired the tavern stand, and well, to make a long story short, then I got married." "Yes," said Lapham, with pride, "I married the school teacher. We did pretty well with the hotel, and my wife she was always at me to paint up. Well, I put it off, and put it off, as a man will, till one day I give in, and says I, well, let's paint up. Why, pert common wife's name's Persis, I've got a whole paint mine out on the farm. Let's go out and look at it." So we drove out. I'd let the place for $75 a year to a shiftless kind of a conuck that had come down that way, and I'd hated to see the house with him in it, but we drove out one Saturday afternoon, and we brought back about a bushel of the stuff in the buggy seat, and I tried it crude, and I tried it burned, and I liked it. M'wife she liked it too. There wa'n't any painter by trade in the village, and I mixed it myself. Well, sir, that tavern's got that coat of paint on it yet, and it hain't ever had any other, and I don't know's it ever will. Well, you know, I felt as if it was a kind of harumscarum experiment, all the while, and I presume I shouldn't have tried it, but I kind of liked to do it because father'd always set so much store by his paint mine. And when I'd got the first coat on, Lapham called it cut, I presume I must have said as much as half an hour, looking at it and thinking how he would have enjoyed it. I've had my share of luck in this world, and I ain't a-going to complain on my own account, but I've noticed that most things get along too late for most people. It made me feel bad, and it took all the pride out my success with the paint, thinking of father. Seemed to me I might have taken more interest in it when he was by to see, but we've got to live and learn. Well, I called my wife out, I tried it on the back of the house, you know, and she left her dishes. I can remember she came out with her sleeves rolled up and sat down alongside of me on the trestle, and says I, "What do you think, Persis?" And says she, "Well, you hain't got a paint mine, Silas Lapham, you've got a gold mine." She always was just so enthusiastic about things. Well, it was just after two or three boats had burned up out west, and a lot of lives lost, and there was a great cry about non-inflammable paint, and I guess that was what was in her mind. "Well, I guess it ain't any gold mine, Persis," says I, "but I guess it is a paint mine. I'm going to have it analyzed, and if it turns out what I think it is, I'm going to work it. And if father hadn't had such a long name, I should call it the Nehemiah Lapham Mineral Paint. But, any rate, every barrel of it, and every keg, and every bottle, and every package, big or little, has got to have the initials and figures NLF 1835, SLT 1855, on it. Father found it in 1835, and I tried it in 1855. ST-1860X. Business, said Bartley.
Yes, said Lapham, but I hadn't heard of plantation bitters then, and I hadn't seen any of the fellow's labels. I set to work and I got a man down from Boston, and I carried him out to the farm, and he analyzed it, made a regular job of it.
Well, sir, we built a kiln, and we kept a lot of that paint ore red hot for 48 hours, kept the Canuck and his family up, firing. The presence of iron in the ore showed with the magnet from the start, and when he came to test it, he found out that it contained about 75% of the peroxide of iron. Lapham pronounced the scientific phrases with a sort of reverent satisfaction, as if awed through his pride by a little lingering uncertainty as to what peroxide was. He accented it as if it were peroxide, and Bartley had to get him to spell it.
Well, and what then? He asked, when he had made a note of the percentage.
What then? Echoed Lapham.
Well, then, the fellow sat down and told me, you've got a paint here, says he, that's going to drive every other mineral paint out of the market.
Why, says he, it'll drive him right into the Back Bay.
Of course, I didn't know what the Back Bay was then, but I begun to open my eyes, thought I'd had him open before, but I guess I hadn't.
Says he, that paint has got hydraulic cement in it, and it can stand fire and water and acids, he named over a lot of things.
Says he, it'll mix easily with linseed oil, whether you want to use it boiled or raw, and it ain't a going to crack nor fade any, and it ain't a going to scale. When you've got your arrangements for burning it properly, you're going to have a paint that will stand like the everlasting hills, in every climate under the sun. Then he went into a lot of particulars, and I begun to think he was drawing a longbow, and meant to make his bill accordingly. So I kept pretty cool, but the fellow's bill didn't amount to anything, hardly said I might pay him after I got going, young chap, and pretty easy, but every word he said was gospel.
Well, I ain't a going to brag up my paint, I don't suppose you came here to hear me blow.
Oh yes, I did, said Bartley. That's what I want. Tell all there is to tell, and I can boil it down afterward. A man can't make a greater mistake with a reporter than to hold back anything out of modesty. It may be the very thing we want to know. What we want is the whole truth, and more, we've got so much modesty of our own that we can temper almost any statement.
Lapham looked as if he did not quite like this tone, and he resumed a little more quietly.
Oh, there isn't really very much more to say about the paint itself. But you can use it for almost anything where a paint is wanted, inside or out. It'll prevent decay, and it'll stop it, after it's begun, in tin or iron. You can paint the inside of a cistern or a bathtub with it, and water won't hurt it, and you can paint a steam boiler with it, and heat won't. You can cover a brick wall with it, or a railroad car, or the deck of a steamboat, and you can't do a better thing for either.
Never tried it on the human conscience, I suppose, suggested Bartley.
No, sir, replied Lapham gravely. I guess you want to keep that as free from paint as you can, if you want much use of it. I never cared to try any of it on mine.
Lapham suddenly lifted his bulk up out of his swivel chair, and led the way out into the wareroom beyond the office partitions, where rows and ranks of casks, barrels, and kegs stretched dimly back to the rear of the building, and diffused an honest, clean, wholesome smell of oil and paint. They were labeled and branded as containing each so many pounds of Lapham's mineral paint, and each bore the Mystic Devices, NLF1835S.L.T. 1855.
There, said Lapham, kicking one of the largest casks with the toe of his boot, that's about our biggest package, and here, he added, laying his hand affectionately on the head of a very small keg, as if it were the head of a child, which it resembled in size, this is the smallest. We used to put the paint on the market dry, but now we grind every ounce of it in oil, very best quality of linseed oil, and warrant it. We find it gives more satisfaction. Now, come back to the office, and I'll show you our fancy brands. It was very cool and pleasant in that dim wareroom, with the rafters showing overhead in a cloudy perspective, and darkening away into the perpetual twilight at the rear of the building, and Bartley had found an agreeable seat on the head of a half barrel of the paint, which he was reluctant to leave. But he rose and followed the vigorous lead of Lapham back to the office, where the sun of a long summer afternoon was just beginning to glare in at the window. On shelves opposite Lapham's desk were tin cans of various sizes, arranged in tapering cylinders, and showing, in a pattern diminishing toward the top, the same label borne by the casks and barrels in the wareroom. Lapham merely waved his hand toward these, but when Bartley, after a comprehensive glance at them, gave his whole attention to a row of clean, smooth jars, where different tints of the paint showed through flawless glass, Lapham smiled, and waited in pleased expectation.
"Hello," said Bartley. "That's pretty."
"Yes," assented Lapham,
It is rather nice. It's our latest thing, and we find it takes with customers first rate. Look here. He said, taking down one of the jars, and pointing to the first line of the label. Bartley Reed, the Persis brand, and then he looked at Lapham and smiled. After her, of course, said Lapham. Got it up and put the first of it on the market her last birthday. She was pleased. I should think she might have been, said Bartley, while he made a note of the appearance of the jars. I don't know about your mentioning it in your interview, said Lapham dubiously. That's going into the interview, Mr. Lapham, if nothing else does. Got a wife myself, and I know just how you feel. It was in the dawn of Bartley's prosperity on the Boston events, before his troubles with Marcia had seriously begun. Is that so? Said Lapham, recognizing with a smile another of the vast majority of married Americans. A few underrate their wives, but the rest think them supernal in intelligence and capability. Well, he added, we must see about that. Where'd you say you lived?
We don't live, we board. Mrs. Nash, 13 Canary Place.
Well, we've all got to commence that way, suggested Lapham consolingly. Yes, but we've about got to the end of our string. I expect to be under a roof of my own on Clover Street before long. I suppose, said Bartley, returning to business, that you didn't let the grass grow under your feet much after you found out what was in your paint mine?
No, sir, answered Lapham, withdrawing his eyes from a long stare at Bartley, in which he had been seeing himself a young man again, in the first days of his married life. I went right back to Lumberville and sold out everything, and put all I could rake and scrape together into paint. And Miss Lapham was with me every time. No hang back about her. I tell you she was a woman.
Bartley laughed. That's the sort most of us marry.
No, we don't, said Lapham. Most of us marry silly little girls grown up to look like women.
Well, I guess that's about so, assented Bartley, as if upon second thought. If it hadn't been for her, resumed Lapham, the paint wouldn't have come to anything. I used to tell her it wanted the 75% of peroxide of iron in the ore that made that paint go. It was the 75% of peroxide of iron in her.
Good, cried Bartley. I'll tell Marcia that.
Unless in 6 months there wa'n't a board fence, nor a bridge girder, nor a dead wall, nor a barn, nor a face of rock in that whole region that didn't have Lapham's mineral paint specimen on it in the three colors we begun by making. Bartley had taken his seat on the windowsill, and Lapham, standing before him, now put up his huge foot close to Bartley's thigh. Neither of them minded that. I've heard a good deal of talk about that ST-1860X man, and the stove blacking man, and the kidney cure man, because they advertised in that way, and I've read articles about it in the papers, but I don't see where the joke comes in, exactly. So long as the people that own the barns and fences don't object, I don't see what the public has got to do with it. And I never saw anything so very sacred about a big rock, along a river or in a pasture, that it wouldn't do to put mineral paint on it in three colors. I wish some of the people that talk about the landscape, and write about it, had to bust one of them rocks out of the landscape with powder, or dig a hole to bury it in, as we used to have to do up on the farm. I guess they'd sing a little different tune about the profanation of scenery. There ain't any man enjoys a sightly bit of nature a smooth piece of interval with half a dozen good-sized wineglass elms in it more than I do. But I ain't a-going to stand up for every big ugly rock I come across, as if we were all a set of dumb druids. I say the landscape was made for man, and not man for the landscape.
Yes, said Bartley carelessly, it was made for the stove polish man and the kidney cure man.
It was made for any man that knows how to use it, Lapham returned, insensible to Bartley's irony. Let him go and live with nature in the winter, up there along the Canada line, and I guess they'll get enough of her for one while.
Well, where was I?
Decorating the landscape, said Bartley.
Yes, sir, I started right there at Lumberville, and it gave the place a start too. You won't find it on the map now, and you won't find it in the Gazetteer. I give a pretty good lump of money to build a town hall, about 5 years back, and the first meeting they held in it they voted to change the name. Lumberville W ain't a name, and it's Lapham now.
Isn't it somewhere up in that region that they get the old Brandon red? Asked Bartley.
We're about 90 miles from Brandon.
The Brandon's a good paint, said Lapham conscientiously. Like to show you round up at our place some odd time, if you get off.
Thanks. I should like it first rate.
Works there?
Yes, works there.
Well, sir, just about the time I got started, the war broke out, and it knocked my paint higher than a kite. The thing dropped perfectly dead.
I presume that if I'd had any sort of influence, I might have got it into government hands, for gun carriages and army wagons, and maybe on board government vessels. But I hadn't, and we had to face the music. I was about broken-hearted, but my wife she looked at it another way. I guess it's a providence, says she. Silas, I guess you've got a country that's worth fighting for. Any rate, you better go out and give it a chance.
Well, sir, I went. I knew she meant business. It might kill her to have me go, but it would kill her sure if I stayed. She was one of that kind. I went. Her last words was, I'll look after the paint, see? We hadn't but just one little girl then, Boyd died, and me Slapham's mother was living with us, and I knew if times did anyways come up again, m'wife know just what to do. So I went. I got through, and you can call me Colonel, if you want to. Feel there. Lapham took Bartley's thumb and forefinger and put them on a bunch in his leg, just above the knee. Anything hard?
Ball?
Lapham nodded.
Gettysburg. That's my thermometer. If it wan't for that, I shouldn't know enough to come in when it rains.
Bartley laughed at a joke which betrayed some evidences of wear. And when you came back, you took hold of the paint and rushed it.
I took hold of the paint and rushed it all I could, said Lapham, with less satisfaction than he had hitherto shown in his autobiography. But I found that I had got back to another world. The day of small things was past, and I don't suppose it will ever come again in this country. My wife was at me all the time to take a partner somebody with capital, but I couldn't seem to bear the idea. That paint was like my own blood to me. To have anybody else concerned and it was like, well, I don't know what. I saw it was the thing to do, but I tried to fight it off, and I tried to joke it off. I used to say, why didn't you take a partner yourself, Persis, while I was away? And she'd say, well, if you hadn't come back, I should, see. Always did like a joke about as well as any woman I ever saw. Well, I had to come to it. I took a partner. Lapham dropped the bold blue eyes with which he had been till now staring into Bartley's face, and the reporter knew that here was a place for asterisks in his interview, if interviews were faithful. He had money enough, continued Lapham, with a suppressed sigh, but he didn't know anything about paint. We hung on together for a year or two. And then we quit. And he had the experience, suggested Bartley, with companionable ease. I had some of the experience too, said Lapham, with a scowl, and Bartley divined, through the freemasonry of all who have sore places in their memories, that this was a point which he must not touch again.
And since that, I suppose, you've played it alone.
I've played it alone.
You must ship some of this paint of yours to foreign countries, Colonel? Suggested Bartley, putting on a professional air.
We ship it to all parts of the world. It goes to South America, lots of it. It goes to Australia, and it goes to India, and it goes to China, and it goes to the Cape of Good Hope. It'll stand any climate. Of course, we don't export these fancy brands much. They're for home use. But we're introducing them elsewhere. Here. Lapham pulled open a drawer, and showed Bartley a lot of labels in different languages: Spanish, French, German, and Italian. We expect to do a good business in all those countries. We've got our agencies in Cadiz now, and in Paris, and in Hamburg, and in Leghorn. It's a thing that's bound to make its way.
Yes, sir. Wherever a man has got a ship, or a bridge, or a lock, or a house, or a car, or a fence, or a pig pen anywhere in God's universe to paint, that's the paint for him, and he's bound to find it out sooner or later. You pass a ton of that paint dry through a blast furnace, and you'll get a quarter of a ton of pig iron. I believe in my paint. I believe it's a blessing to the world. When folks come in, and kind of smell round, and ask me what I mix it with, I always say, well, in the first place, I mix it with faith, and after that I grind it up with the best quality of boiled linseed oil that money will buy. Lapham took out his watch and looked at it, and Bartley perceived that his audience was drawing to a close. If you ever want to run down and take a look at our works, pass you over the road, he called it Rudd, and it shan't cost you a cent.
Well, maybe I shall, sometime, said Bartley.
Good afternoon, Colonel.
Good afternoon.
Or hold on. My horse down there yet, William? He called to the young man in the counting room who had taken his letter at the beginning of the interview.
Oh. All right. He added, in response to something the young man said.
Can't I set you down somewhere, Mr. Hubbard? I've got my horse at the door, and I can drop you on my way home. I'm going to take me Slapham to look at a house I'm driving piles for, down on the new land.
Don't care if I do, said Bartley.
Lapham put on a straw hat, gathered up some papers lying on his desk, pulled down its rolling cover, turned the key in it, and gave the papers to an extremely handsome young woman at one of the desks in the outer office. She was stylishly dressed, as Bartley saw, and her smooth, yellow hair was sculpturesquely waved over a low, white forehead. "Here," said Lapham, with the same prompt gruff kindness that he had used in addressing the young man, "I want you should put these in shape, and give me a typewriter copy tomorrow."
"What an uncommonly pretty girl," said Bartley, as they descended the rough stairway and found their way out to the street, past the dangling rope of a block and tackle wandering up into the cavernous darkness overhead.
"She does her work," said Lapham shortly. Bartley mounted to the left side of the open buggy standing at the curbstone, and Lapham, gathering up the hitching weight, slid it under the buggy seat and mounted beside him.
"No chance to speed a horse here, of course," said Lapham, while the horse with a spirited gentleness picked her way, with a high, long action, over the pavement of the street. The streets were all narrow, and most of them crooked, in that quarter of the town, but at the end of one the spars of a vessel penciled themselves delicately against the cool blue of the afternoon sky. The air was full of a smell pleasantly compounded of oakum, of leather, and of oil. It was not the busy season, and they met only two or three trucks heavily straggling toward the wharf with their long string teams, but the cobblestones of the pavement were worn with the dint of ponderous wheels, and discolored with iron rust from them. Here and there, in wandering streaks over its surface, was the gray stain of the salt water with which the street had been sprinkled. After an interval of some minutes, which both men spent in looking round the dashboard from opposite sides to watch the stride of the horse, Bartley said, with a light sigh, "I had a colt once down in Maine that stepped just like that mare."
"Well," said Lapham, sympathetically recognizing the bond that this fact created between them.
"Well, now, I tell you what you do. You let me come for you most any afternoon, now, and take you out over the milldam, and speed this mare a little. I'd like to show you what this mare can do."
"Yes, I would."
"All right," answered Bartley, "I'll let you know my first day off."
"Good," cried Lapham.
"Kentucky?" queried Bartley.
"No, sir. I don't ride behind anything but Vermont, never did.
Touch of Morgan, of course, but you can't have much Morgan in a horse if you want speed. Hambletonian mostly. Where'd you say you wanted to get out?"
"I guess you may put me down at the events office, just round the corner here. I've got to write up this interview while it's fresh."
"All right," said Lapham, impersonally assenting to Bartley's use of him as material. He had not much to complain of in Bartley's treatment, unless it was the strain of extravagant compliment which it involved. But the flattery was mainly for the paint, whose virtues Lapham did not believe could be overstated, and himself and his history had been treated with as much respect as Bartley was capable of showing anyone. He made a very picturesque thing of the discovery of the paint mine. Deep in the heart of the virgin forests of Vermont, far up toward the line of the Canadian snows, on a desolate mountainside, where an autumnal storm had done its wild work, and the great trees, strewn hither and thither, bore witness to its violence, Nehemiah Lapham discovered, just 40 years ago, the mineral which the alchemy of his son's enterprise and energy has transmuted into solid ingots of the most precious of metals. The colossal fortune of Colonel Silas Lapham lay at the bottom of a hole which an uprooted tree had dug for him, and which for many years remained a paint mine of no more appreciable value than a soap mine. Here Bartley had not been able to forego another grin, but he compensated for it by the high reverence with which he spoke of Colonel Lapham's record during the War of the Rebellion, and of the motives which impelled him to turn aside from an enterprise in which his whole heart was engaged, and take part in the struggle. The colonel bears embedded in the muscle of his right leg a little memento of the period in the shape of a mini ball, which he jocularly referred to as his thermometer, and which relieves him from the necessity of reading the probabilities in his morning paper. This saves him just so much time, and for a man who, as he said, has not a moment of waste time on him anywhere, 5 minutes a day or something in the course of a year. Simple, clear, bold, and straightforward in mind and action, Colonel Silas Lapham, with a prompt comprehensiveness and a never-failing business sagacity, is, in the best sense of that much-abused term, one of nature's noblemen, to the last inch of his 5'11½". His life affords an example of single-minded application and unwavering perseverance which our young businessmen would do well to emulate. There is nothing showy or meretricious about the man. He believes in mineral paint, and he puts his heart and soul into it. He makes it a religion, though we would not imply that it is his religion. Colonel Lapham is a regular attendant at the Reverend Dr. Langworthy's church. He subscribes liberally to the Associated Charities, and no good object or worthy public enterprise fails to receive his support. He is not now actively in politics, and his paint is not partisan, but it is an open secret that he is, and always has been, a staunch Republican. Without violating the sanctities of private life, we cannot speak fully of various details which came out in the free and unembarrassed interview which Colonel Lapham accorded our representative. But we may say that the success of which he is justly proud, he is also proud to attribute in great measure to the sympathy and energy of his wife, one of those women who, in whatever walk of life, seem born to honor the name of American woman, and to redeem it from the national reproach of Daisy Millerism. Of Colonel Lapham's family, we will simply add that it consists of two young lady daughters. The subject of this very inadequate sketch is building a house on the water side of Beacon Street, after designs by one of our leading architectural firms, which, when complete, will be one of the finest ornaments of that exclusive avenue. It will, we believe, be ready for the occupancy of the family sometime in the spring. When Bartley had finished his article, which he did with a good deal of inward derision, he went home to Marcia, still smiling over the thought of Lapham, whose burly simplicity had peculiarly amused him. "He regularly turned himself inside out to me," he said, as he sat describing his interview to Marcia. "Then I know you could make something nice out of it," said his wife, "and that will please Mr. Witherby." "Oh yes, I've done pretty well, but I couldn't let myself loose on him the way I wanted to. Confound the limitations of decency, anyway. I should like to have told just what Colonel Lapham thought of landscape advertising in Colonel Lapham's own words. I'll tell you one thing, Marsh, he had a girl there at one of the desks that you wouldn't let me have within gunshot of my office. Pretty? It ain't any name for it." Marsh's eyes began to blaze, and Bartley broke out into a laugh, in which he arrested himself at sight of a formidable parcel in the corner of the room. "Hello! What's that?" "Why, I don't know what it is," replied Marcia tremulously. "A man brought it just before you came in, and I didn't like to open it." "Think it was some kind of infernal machine?" asked Bartley, getting down on his knees to examine the package. "Mrs. B. Hubbard, hey?" He cut the heavy hamstring with his penknife. "We must look into this thing. I should like to know who's sending packages to Mrs. Hubbard in my absence." He unfolded the wrappings of paper, growing softer and finer inward, and presently pulled out a handsome square glass jar, through which a crimson mass showed richly. "The Persis brand," he yelled. "I knew it." "Oh, what is it, Bartley?" quavered Marcia. Then, courageously drawing a little nearer, "Is it some kind of jam?" she implored. "Jam? No," roared Bartley. "It's paint. It's mineral paint, Lapham's paint." "Paint?" echoed Marcia, as she stood over him while he stripped their wrappings from the jars, which showed the dark blue, dark green, light brown, dark brown, and black, with the dark crimson, forming the gamut of color of the Lapham paint. "Don't tell me it's paint that I can use, Bartley." "Well, I shouldn't advise you to use much of it all at once," replied her husband. "But it's paint that you can use in moderation." Marcia cast her arms round his neck and kissed him. "Oh Bartley, I think I'm the happiest girl in the world. I was just wondering what I should do. There are places in that Clover Street house that need touching up so dreadfully. I shall be very careful. You needn't be afraid I shall overdo. But, this just saves my life. Did you buy it, Bartley? You know we couldn't afford it, and you oughtn't to have done it. And what does the Persis brand mean?" "Buy it?" cried Bartley. "No. The old fool sent it to you as a present. You'd better wait for the facts before you pitch into me for extravagance, Marcia. Persis is the name of his wife, and he named it after her because it's his finest brand. You'll see it in my interview. Put it on the market her last birthday for a surprise to her." "What old fool?" faltered Marcia. "Why, Lapham the mineral paint man." "Oh, what a good man," sighed Marcia from the bottom of her soul. "Bartley, you won't make fun of him as you do of some of those people? Will you?" "Nothing that he'll ever find out," said Bartley, getting up and brushing off the carpet lint from his knees, too. After dropping Bartley Hubbard at the events building, Lapham drove on down Washington Street to Nankeen Square at the South End, where he had lived ever since the mistaken movement of society in that direction ceased. He had not built, but had bought very cheap of a terrified gentleman of good extraction who discovered too late that the South End was not the thing, and who in the eagerness of his flight to the Back Bay threw in his carpets and shades for almost nothing. Mrs. Lapham was even better satisfied with their bargain than the Colonel himself, and they had lived in Nankeen Square for 12 years. They had seen the saplings planted in the pretty oval round which the houses were built flourish up into sturdy young trees, and their two little girls in the same period had grown into young ladies. The Colonel's tough frame had expanded into the bulk which Bartley's interview indicated, and Mrs. Lapham, while keeping a more youthful outline,
showed the sharp print of the crow's foot at the corners of her motherly eyes, and certain slight creases in her wholesome cheeks. The fact that they lived in an unfashionable neighborhood was something that they had never been made to feel to their personal disadvantage, and they had hardly known it till the summer before this story opens, when Mrs. Lapham and her daughter Irene had met some other Bostonians far from Boston, who made it memorable. They were people whom chance had brought for the time under a singular obligation to the Lapham ladies, and they were gratefully recognizant of it. They had ventured a mother and two daughters as far as a rather wild little Canadian watering place on the St. Lawrence, below Quebec, and had arrived some days before their son and brother was expected to join them. Two of their trunks had gone astray, and on the night of their arrival the mother was taken violently ill. Mrs. Lapham came to their help, with her skill as nurse, and with the abundance of her own and her daughter's wardrobe, and a profuse, single-hearted kindness. When a doctor could be got at, he said that but for Mrs. Lapham's timely care, the lady would hardly have lived. He was a very effusive little Frenchman, and fancied he was saying something very pleasant to everybody. A certain intimacy inevitably followed, and when the son came he was even more grateful than the others. Mrs. Lapham could not quite understand why he should be as attentive to her as to Irene, but she compared him with other young men about the place, and thought him nicer than any of them. She had not the means of a wider comparison, for in Boston, with all her husband's prosperity, they had not had a social life. Their first years there were given to careful getting on Lapham's part, and careful saving on his wife's. Suddenly the money began to come so abundantly that she need not save, and then they did not know what to do with it. A certain amount could be spent on horses, and Lapham spent it, his wife spent on rich and rather ugly clothes and the luxury of household appointments. Lapham had not yet reached the picture-buying stage of the rich man's development, but they decorated their house with the costliest and most abominable frescoes, they went upon journeys, and lavished upon cars and hotels, they gave with both hands to their church and to all the charities it brought them acquainted with, but they did not know how to spend on society. Up to a certain period Mrs. Lapham had the ladies of her neighborhood into tea, as her mother had done in the country in her younger days. Lapham's idea of hospitality was still to bring a heavy-buying customer home to potluck, neither of them imagined dinners. Their two girls had gone to the public schools, where they had not got on as fast as some of the other girls, so that they were a year behind in graduating from the grammar school, where Lapham thought that they had got education enough. His wife was of a different mind. She would have liked them to go to some private school for their finishing. But Irene did not care for study, she preferred housekeeping, and both the sisters were afraid of being snubbed by the other girls, who were of a different sort from the girls of the grammar school. These were mostly from the parks and squares, like themselves. It ended in their going part of a year. But the elder had an odd taste of her own for reading, and she took some private lessons, and read books out of the circulating library. The whole family were amazed at the number she read, and rather proud of it. They were not girls who embroidered or abandoned themselves to needlework. Irene spent her abundant leisure in shopping for herself and her mother, of whom both daughters made a kind of idol, buying her caps and laces out of their pin money, and getting her dresses far beyond her capacity to wear. Irene dressed herself very stylishly, and spent hours on her toilet every day. Her sister had a simpler taste, and, if she had done altogether as she liked, might even have slighted dress. They all three took long naps every day, and sat hours together minutely discussing what they saw out of the window. In her self-guided search for self-improvement, the elder sister went to many church lectures on a vast variety of secular subjects, and usually came home with a comic account of them, and that made more matter of talk for the whole family. She could make fun of nearly everything. Irene complained that she scared away the young men whom they got acquainted with at the dancing school sociables. They were, perhaps, not the wisest young men. The girls had learned to dance at Papanti's, but they had not belonged to the private classes. They did not even know of them, and a great gulf divided them from those who did. Their father did not like company, except such as came informally in their way, and their mother had remained too rustic to know how to attract it in the sophisticated city fashion. None of them had grasped the idea of European travel, but they had gone about to mountain and seaside resorts, the mother and the two girls, where they witnessed the spectacle which such resorts present throughout New England, of multitudes of girls, lovely, accomplished, exquisitely dressed, humbly glad of the presence of any sort of young man, but the Laphams had no skill or courage to make themselves noticed, far less courted by the solitary invalid, or clergyman, or artist. They lurked helplessly about in the hotel parlors, looking on and not knowing how to put themselves forward. Perhaps they did not care a great deal to do so. They had not a conceit of themselves, but a sort of content in their own ways that one may notice in certain families. The very strength of their mutual affection was a barrier to worldly knowledge. They dressed for one another, they equipped their house for their own satisfaction, they lived richly to themselves, not because they were selfish, but because they did not know how to do otherwise. The elder daughter did not care for society, apparently. The younger, who was but 3 years younger, was not yet quite old enough to be ambitious of it. With all her wonderful beauty, she had an innocence almost vegetable. When her beauty, which in its immaturity was crude and harsh, suddenly ripened, she bloomed and glowed with the unconsciousness of a flower. She not merely did not feel herself admired, but hardly knew herself discovered. If she dressed well, perhaps too well, it was because she had the instinct of dress, but till she met this young man who was so nice to her at Bay St. Paul, she had scarcely lived a detached, individual life, so wholly had she depended on her mother and her sister for her opinions, almost her sensations. She took account of everything he did and said, pondering it, and trying to make out exactly what he meant, to the inflection of a syllable, the slightest movement or gesture. In this way she began for the first time to form ideas which she had not derived from her family, and they were nonetheless her own because they were often mistaken. Some of the things that he partly said, partly looked, she reported to her mother, and they talked them over, as they did everything relating to these new acquaintances, and wrought them into the novel point of view which they were acquiring. When Mrs. Lapham returned home, she submitted all the accumulated facts of the case, and all her own conjectures, to her husband, and canvassed them anew. At first he was disposed to regard the whole affair as of small importance, and she had to insist a little beyond her own convictions in order to counteract his indifference. "Well, I can tell you," she said, "that if you think they were not the nicest people you ever saw, you're mightily mistaken. They had about the best manners, and they had been everywhere, and knew everything. I declare it made me feel as if we had always lived in the backwoods. I don't know but the mother and the daughters would have let you feel so a little, if they'd showed out all they thought, but they never did, and the son, well, I can't express it, Silas. But that young man had about perfect ways."
"Seem struck up on Irene?" asked the colonel.
"How can I tell? He seemed just about as much struck up on me. Anyway, he paid me as much attention as he did her. Perhaps it's more the way, now, to notice the mother than it used to be."
Lapham ventured no conjecture, but asked, as he had asked already, who the people were.
Mrs. Lapham repeated their name.
Lapham nodded his head.
"Do you know them? What business is he in?"
"I guess he ain't in anything," said Lapham.
"They were very nice," said Mrs. Lapham impartially.
"Well, they'd ought to be," returned the colonel. "Never done anything else."
"They didn't seem stuck up," urged his wife.
"They'd no need to with you. I could buy him and sell him, twice over." This answer satisfied Mrs. Lapham rather with the fact than with her husband.
"Well, I guess I wouldn't brag, Silas," she said. In the winter the ladies of this family, who returned to town very late, came to call on Mrs. Lapham. They were again very polite. But the mother let drop, in apology for their calling almost at nightfall, that the coachman had not known the way exactly.
"Nearly all our friends are on the new land or on the hill." There was a barb in this that rankled after the ladies had gone, and on comparing notes with her daughter, Mrs. Lapham found that a barb had been left to rankle in her mind also. They said they had never been in this part of the town before. Upon a strict search of her memory, Irene could not report that the fact had been stated with anything like insinuation, but it was that which gave it a more penetrating effect.
"Oh, well, of course," said Lapham, to whom these facts were referred. "Those sort of people haven't got much business up our way, and they don't come. It's a fair thing all round. We don't trouble the hill or the new land much."
"We know where they are," suggested his wife thoughtfully.
"Yes," assented the colonel. "I know where they are. I've got a lot of land over on the Back Bay."
"You have?" eagerly demanded his wife.
"Want me to build on it?" he asked in reply, with a quizzical smile. "I guess we can get along here for a while." This was at night. In the morning Mrs. Lapham said, "I suppose we ought to do the best we can for the children, in every way."
"I supposed we always had," replied her husband.
"Yes, we have, according to our light."
"Have you got some new light?"
"I don't know as it's light. But if the girls are going to keep on living in Boston and marry here, I presume we ought to try to get them into society, some way, or ought to do something."
"Well, who's ever done more for their children than we have?" demanded Lapham, with a pang at the thought that he could possibly have been outdone. "Don't they have everything they want? Don't they dress just as you say? Don't you go everywhere with them? Is there ever anything going on that's worthwhile that they don't see it or hear it?"
"I don't know what you mean.
Why don't you get them into society? There's money enough.
There's got to be something besides money, I guess, said Mrs. Lapham, with a hopeless sigh. I presume we didn't go to work just the right way about their schooling. We ought to have got them into some school where they'd have got acquainted with city girls, girls who could help them along.
Nearly everybody at Miss Smealy's was from somewhere else.
Well, it's pretty late to think about that now, grumbled Lapham.
And we've always gone our own way, and not looked out for the future. We ought to have gone out more, and had people come to the house. Nobody comes.
Well, is that my fault? I guess nobody ever makes people welcomer.
We ought to have invited company more.
Why don't you do it now? If it's for the girls, I don't care if you have the house full all the while.
Mrs. Lapham was forced to a confession full of humiliation. I don't know who to ask.
Well, you can't expect me to tell you.
No, we're both country people, and we've kept our country ways, and we don't, either of us, know what to do.
You've had to work so hard, and your luck was so long coming, and then it came with such a rush, that we haven't had any chance to learn what to do with it.
It's just the same with Irene's looks. I didn't expect she was ever going to have any. She was such a plain child, and, all at once, she's blazed out this way. As long as it was Penn that didn't seem to care for society, I didn't give much mind to it. But I can see it's going to be different with Irene. I don't believe but what we're in the wrong neighborhood.
Well, said the colonel, there ain't a prettier lot on the Back Bay than mine. It's on the water side of Beacon, and it's 28 feet wide and 150 deep. Let's build on it.
Mrs. Lapham was silent a while.
No, she said finally, we've always got along well enough here, and I guess we better stay.
At breakfast she said casually, girls, how would you like to have your father build on the new land?
The girls said they did not know. It was more convenient to the horse cars where they were.
Mrs. Lapham stole a look of relief at her husband, and nothing more was said of the matter. The mother of the family who had called upon Mrs. Lapham brought her husband's cards, and when Mrs. Lapham returned the visit she was in some trouble about the proper form of acknowledging the civility. The colonel had no card but a business card, which advertised the principal depot and the several agencies of the mineral paint, and Mrs. Lapham doubted, till she wished to goodness that she had never seen nor heard of those people, whether to ignore her husband and the transaction altogether, or to write his name on her own card. She decided finally upon this measure, and she had the relief of not finding the family at home. As far as she could judge, Irene seemed to suffer a little disappointment from the fact. For several months there was no communication between the families. Then there came to Nankeen Square a lithographed circular from the people on the hill, signed in ink by the mother, and affording Mrs. Lapham an opportunity to subscribe for a charity of undeniable merit and acceptability. She submitted it to her husband, who promptly drew a check for $500. She tore it in two. I will take a check for $100, Silas, she said.
Why? He asked, looking up guiltily at her.
Because $100 is enough, and I don't want to show off before them.
Oh, I thought maybe you did.
Well, Pert, he added, having satisfied human nature by the preliminary thrust, I guess you're about right. When do you want I should begin to build on Beacon Street? He handed her the new check, where she stood over him, and then leaned back in his chair and looked up at her.
I don't want you should begin at all.
What do you mean, Silas? She rested against the side of his desk.
Well, I don't know as I mean anything. But shouldn't you like to build?
Everybody builds, at least once in a lifetime.
Where is your lot?
They say it's unhealthy, over there. Up to a certain point in their prosperity Mrs. Lapham had kept strict account of all her husband's affairs, but as they expanded, and ceased to be of the retail nature with which women successfully grapple, the intimate knowledge of them made her nervous. There was a period in which she felt that they were being ruined, but the crash had not come, and, since his great success, she had abandoned herself to a blind confidence in her husband's judgment, which she had hitherto felt needed her revision. He came and went, day by day, unquestioned. He bought and sold and got gain. She knew that he would tell her if ever things went wrong, and he knew that she would ask him whenever she was anxious.
It ain't unhealthy where I bought, said Lapham, rather enjoying her insinuation.
I looked after that when I was trading, and I guess it's about as healthy on the Back Bay as it is here, anyway.
I got that lot for you, Pert, I thought you'd want to build on the Back Bay someday.
Pshaw! Said Mrs. Lapham, deeply pleased inwardly, but not going to show it, as she would have said. I guess you want to build there yourself. She insensibly got a little nearer to her husband. They like to talk to each other in that blunt way. It is the New England way of expressing perfect confidence and tenderness.
Well, I guess I do,
said Lapham, not insisting upon the unselfish view of the matter. I always did like the water side of Beacon. There ain't a sightlier place in the world for a house. And someday there's bound to be a driveway all along behind them houses, between them and the water, and then a lot there is going to be worth the gold that will cover it coin. I've had offers for that lot, pert, twice over what I give for it.
Yes, I have. Don't you want to ride over there some afternoon with me and see it?
I'm satisfied where we be, see, said Mrs. Lapham, recurring to the parlance of her youth and her pathos at her husband's kindness. She sighed anxiously, for she felt the trouble a woman knows in view of any great change. They had often talked of altering over the house in which they lived, but they had never come to it, and they had often talked of building, but it had always been a house in the country that they had thought of.
I wish you had sold that lot.
I hain't, said the colonel briefly. I don't know as I feel much like changing our way of living. Guess we could live there pretty much as we live here. There's all kinds of people on Beacon Street, you mustn't think they're all big bugs. I know one party that lives in a house he built to sell, and his wife don't keep any girl. You can have just as much style there as you want, for just as little. I guess we live as well as most of them now, and set as good a table. And if you come to style, I don't know as anybody has got more of a right to put it on than what we have.
Well, I don't want it to build on Beacon Street, see, said Mrs. Lapham gently.
Just as you please, Persis. I ain't in any hurry to leave. Mrs. Lapham stood flapping the check which she held in her right hand against the edge of her left. The colonel still sat looking up at her face, and watching the effect of the poison of ambition which he had artfully instilled into her mind. She sighed again a yielding sigh.
What are you going to do this afternoon?
I'm going to take a turn on the Brighton Road, said the colonel.
I don't believe but what I should like to go along, said his wife.
All right. You hain't ever rode behind that mare yet, Pert, and I want you should see me let her out once. They say the snow's all packed down already, and the going is A1. At 4 o'clock in the afternoon, with a cold, red winter sunset before them, the colonel and his wife were driving slowly down Beacon Street in the light, high-seated cutter, where, as he said, they were a pretty tight fit. He was holding the mare until the time came to speed her, and the mare was springily jolting over the snow, looking intelligently from side to side, and cocking this here and that, while from her nostrils, her head tossing easily, she blew quick, irregular whiffs of steam.
Gay, ain't she?
Proudly suggested the colonel.
She is gay, assented his wife.
They met swiftly dashing sleighs, and let them pass on either hand, down the beautiful avenue narrowing with an admirably even skyline in the perspective. They were not in a hurry. The mare jounced easily along, and they talked of the different houses on either side of the way. They had a crude taste in architecture, and they admired the worst. There were women's faces at many of the handsome windows, and once in a while a young man on the pavement caught his hat suddenly from his head, and bowed in response to some salutation from within.
I don't think our girls would look very bad behind one of those big panes, said the colonel.
No, said his wife dreamily.
Where's the young man? Did he come with them?
No, he was to spend the winter with a friend of his that has a ranch in Texas. I guess he's got to do something.
Yes, gentlemaning as a profession has got to play out in a generation or two.
Neither of them spoke of the lot, though Lapham knew perfectly well what his wife had come with him for, and she was aware that he knew it. The time came when he brought the mare down to a walk, and then slowed up almost to a stop, while they both turned their heads to the right and looked at the vacant lot, through which showed the frozen stretch of the Back Bay, a section of the Long Bridge, and the roofs and smokestacks of Charlestown.
Yes, it's sightly, said Mrs. Lapham, lifting her hand from the reins, on which she had unconsciously laid it.
Lapham said nothing, but he let the mare out a little. The sleighs and cutters were thickening round them. On the mill dam it became difficult to restrict the mare to the long, slow trot into which he let her break. The beautiful landscape widened to right and left of them, with the sunset redder and redder, over the low, irregular hills before them. They crossed the mill dam into Longwood, and here, from the crest of the first upland, stretched two endless lines, in which thousands of cutters went and came. Some of the drivers were already speeding their horses, and these shot to and fro on inner lines, between the slowly moving vehicles on either side of the road. Here and there burly mounted policemen, bulging over the pommel of his McClellan saddle, jolted by, silently gesturing and directing the course, and keeping it all under the eye of the law. It was what Bartley Hubbard called a carnival of fashion and gaiety on the Brighton Road, in his account of it. But most of the people in those elegant sleighs and cutters had so little the air of the great world that one knowing it at all must have wondered where they and their money came from, and the gaiety of the men, at least, was expressed, like that of Colonel Lapham, in a grim, almost fierce alertness, the women wore an air of courageous apprehension. At a certain point the colonel said, "I'm going to let her out, Pert," and he lifted and then dropped the reins lightly on the mare's back. She understood the signal, and, as an admirer said, she laid down to her work. Nothing in the immutable iron of Lapham's face betrayed his sense of triumph as the mare left everything behind her on the road. Mrs. Lapham, if she felt fear, was too busy holding her flying wraps about her, and shielding her face from the scud of ice flung from the mare's heels, to betray it, except for the rush of her feet. The mare was as silent as the people behind her, the muscles of her back and thighs worked more and more swiftly, like some mechanism responding to an alien force, and she shot to the end of the course, grazing 100 encountered and rival sledges in her passage, but unmolested by the policemen, who probably saw that the mare and the colonel knew what they were about, and, at any rate, were not the sort of men to interfere with trotting like that. At the end of the heat Lapham drew her in, and turned off on a side street into Brookline. "Tell you what, Pert," he said, as if they had been quietly jogging along, with time for uninterrupted thought since he last spoke, "I've about made up my mind to build on that lot."
"All right, Silas," said Mrs. Lapham, "I suppose you know what you're about. Don't build on it for me, that's all."
When she stood in the hall at home, taking off her things, she said to the girls, who were helping her, "Someday your father will get killed with that mare."
"Did he speed her?" asked Penelope, the elder.
She was named after her grandmother, who had in her turn inherited from another ancestress the name of the Homeric matron whose peculiar merits won her a place even among the Puritan faiths, hopes, temperances, and prudences. Penelope was the girl whose odd serious face had struck Bartley Hubbard in the photograph of the family group Lapham showed him on the day of the interview. Her large eyes, like her hair, were brown, they had the peculiar look of near-sighted eyes which is called mooning, her complexion was of a dark pallor. Her mother did not reply to a question which might be considered already answered. "He says he's going to build on that lot of his," she next remarked, unwinding the long veil which she had tied round her neck to hold her bonnet on. She put her hat and cloak on the hall table, to be carried upstairs later, and they all went into tea, creamed oysters, birds, hot biscuit, two kinds of cake, and dishes of stewed and canned fruit and honey. The women dined alone at one, and the colonel at the same hour downtown. But he liked a good hot meal when he got home in the evening. The house flared with gas, and the colonel, before he sat down, went about shutting the registers, through which a welding heat came voluming up from the furnace. "I'll be the death of that darkie yet," he said, "if he don't stop making on such a fire. The only way to get any comfort out of your furnace is to take care of it yourself."
"Well," answered his wife from behind the teapot, as he sat down at table with this threat, "there's nothing to prevent you, see. And you can shovel the snow too, if you want it till you get over to Beacon Street, anyway."
"I guess I can keep my own sidewalk on Beacon Street clean, if I take the notion."
"I should like to see you at it," retorted his wife.
"Well, you keep a sharp lookout, and maybe you will." Their taunts were really expressions of affectionate pride in each other. They liked to have it, give and take, that way, as they would have said, right along. A man can be a man on Beacon Street as well as anywhere, I guess.
"Well, I'll do the wash, as I used to in Lumberville," said Mrs. Lapham. "I presume you'll let me have set tubs, see. You know I ain't so young anymore." She passed Irene a cup of oolong tea, none of them had a sufficiently cultivated palate for souchong, and the girl handed it to her father.
"Papa," she asked, "you don't really mean that you're going to build over there?"
"Don't I?
You wait and see," said the colonel, stirring his tea.
"I don't believe you do," pursued the girl.
"Is that so? I presume you'd hate to have me."
"Your mother does," he said, "does, of course."
Penelope took the word. "I go in for it. I don't see any use in not enjoying money, if you've got it to enjoy. That's what it's for, I suppose, though you mightn't always think so." She had a slow, quaint way of talking, that seemed a pleasant personal modification of some ancestral Yankee drawl, and her voice was low and cozy, and so far from being nasal that it was a little hoarse.
"I guess the eyes has it, Pen," said her father. "How would it do to let Irene and your mother stick in the old place here, and us go into the new house?" At times the colonel's grammar failed him. The matter dropped, and the Laphams lived on as before, with joking recurrences to the house on the water side of Beacon. The colonel seemed less in earnest than any of them about it, but that was his way, his girls said, you never could tell when he really meant a thing. 3. Toward the end of the winter there came a newspaper, addressed to Miss Irene Lapham. It proved to be a Texas newspaper,
with a complimentary account of the ranch of the Honorable Loring G. Stanton, which the representative of the journal had visited. "It must be his friend," said Mrs. Lapham, to whom her daughter brought the paper, "the one he's staying with." The girl did not say anything, but she carried the paper to her room, where she scanned every line of it for another name. She did not find it, but she cut the notice out and stuck it into the side of her mirror, where she could read it every morning when she brushed her hair, and the last thing at night when she looked at herself in the glass just before turning off the gas. Her sister often read it aloud, standing behind her and rendering it with elocutionary effects. "The first time I ever heard of a love letter in the form of a puff to a cattle ranch. But perhaps that's the style on the hill." Mrs. Lapham told her husband of the arrival of the paper, treating the fact with an importance that he refused to see in it. "How do you know the fellow sent it, anyway?" he demanded. "Oh, I know he did. I don't see why he couldn't write to Renee, if he really meant anything." "Well, I guess that wouldn't be their way," said Mrs. Lapham. She did not at all know what their way would be. When the spring opened, Colonel Lapham showed that he had been in earnest about building on the new land. His idea of a house was a brownstone front, 4 stories high, and a French roof with an air chamber above. Inside, there was to be a reception room on the street and a dining room back. The parlors were to be on the second floor, and finished in black walnut or party-colored paint. The chambers were to be on the 3 floors above, front and rear, with side rooms over the front door. Black walnut was to be used everywhere except in the attic, which was to be painted and grained to look like black walnut. The whole was to be very high studded, and there were to be handsome cornices and elaborate centerpieces throughout, except, again, in the attic. These ideas he had formed from the inspection of many new buildings which he had seen going up, and which he had a passion for looking into. He was confirmed in his ideas by a master builder who had put up a great many houses on the Back Bay as a speculation, and who told him that if he wanted to have a house in the style, that was the way to have it. The beginnings of the process by which Lapham escaped from the master builder and ended in the hands of an architect are so obscure that it would be almost impossible to trace them. But it all happened, and Lapham promptly developed his ideas of black walnut finish, high studding, and cornices. The architect was able to conceal the shutter which they must have sent through him. He was skillful, as nearly all architects are, in playing upon that simple instrument man. He began to touch Colonel Lapham's stops. "Oh, certainly, have the parlors high studded. But you've seen some of those pretty old-fashioned country houses, haven't you, where the entrance story is very low studded?" "Yes," Lapham assented. "Well, don't you think something of that kind would have a very nice effect? Have the entrance story low studded, and your parlors on the next floor as high as you please. Put your little reception room here beside the door, and get the whole width of your house frontage for a square hall, and an easy low tread staircase running up 3 sides of it. I'm sure Mrs. Lapham would find it much pleasanter." The architect caught toward him a scrap of paper lying on the table at which they were sitting and sketched his idea. "Then have your dining room behind the hall, looking on the water." He glanced at Mrs. Lapham, who said, "Of course," and the architect went on. "That gets you rid of one of those long, straight, ugly staircases." Until that moment Lapham had thought a long, straight staircase the chief ornament of a house, and gives you an effect of amplitude and space. "That's so," said Mrs. Lapham. Her husband merely made a noise in his throat. "Then, were you thinking of having your parlors together, connected by folding doors?" asked the architect deferentially. "Yes, of course," said Lapham. "They're always so, ain't they?" "Well, nearly," said the architect. "I was wondering how would it do to make one large square room at the front, taking the whole breadth of the house, and, with this hall space between, have a music room back for the young ladies?" Lapham looked helplessly at his wife, whose quicker apprehension had followed the architect's pencil with instant sympathy. "First rate," she cried. The colonel gave way. "I guess that would do. It'll be kind of odd, won't it?" "Well, I don't know," said the architect. "Not so odd, I hope, as the other thing will be a few years from now." He went on to plan the rest of the house, and he showed himself such a master in regard to all the practical details that Mrs. Lapham began to feel a motherly affection for the young man, and her husband could not deny in his heart that the fellow seemed to understand his business. He stopped walking about the room, as he had begun to do when the architect and Mrs. Lapham entered into the particulars of closets, drainage, kitchen arrangements, and all that, and came back to the table. "I presume," he said, "you'll have the drawing room finished in black walnut?" "Well, yes," replied the architect, "if you like. But some less expensive wood can be made just as effective with paint.
Of course you can paint black walnut too.
Paint it? Gasped the colonel.
Yes, said the architect quietly. White, or a little off-white. Lapham dropped the plan he had picked up from the table. His wife made a little move toward him of consolation or support.
Of course, resumed the architect, I know there has been a great craze for black walnut. But it's an ugly wood, and for a drawing room there is really nothing like white paint. We should want to introduce a little gold here and there. Perhaps we might run a painted frieze round under the cornice garlands of roses on a gold ground, it would tell wonderfully in a white room.
The colonel returned less courageously to the charge. I presume you'll want East Lake mantel shelves and tiles? He meant this for a sarcastic thrust at a prevailing foible of the profession.
Well, no, gently answered the architect. I was thinking perhaps a white marble chimneypiece, treated in the refined Empire style, would be the thing for that room.
White marble! Exclaimed the colonel. I thought that had gone out long ago.
Really beautiful things can't go out. They may disappear for a little while, but they must come back. It's only the ugly things that stay out after they've had their day.
Lapham could only venture very modestly, hardwood floors?
In the music room, of course, consented the architect.
And in the drawing room?
Carpet. Some sort of moquette, I should say. But I should prefer to consult Mrs. Lapham's taste in that matter.
And in the other rooms?
Oh, carpets, of course.
And what about the stairs?
Carpet.
And I should have the rail and banisters, white banisters, turned or twisted.
The colonel said under his breath, well, I'm dumbed. But he gave no utterance to his astonishment in the architect's presence.
When he went at last, the session did not end till 11 o'clock, Lapham said, well, Pert, I guess that fellow's 50 years behind, or 10 years ahead. I wonder what the Empire style is?
I don't know. I hated to ask. But he seemed to understand what he was talking about. I declare, he knows what a woman wants in a house better than she does herself.
And a man's simply nowhere in comparison, said Lapham. But he respected a fellow who could beat him at every point, and have a reason ready, as this architect had, and when he recovered from the days into which the complete upheaval of all his preconceived notions had left him, he was in a fit state to swear by the architect. It seemed to him that he had discovered the fellow, as he always called him, and owned him now, and the fellow did nothing to disturb this impression. He entered into that brief but intense intimacy with the Laphams which the sympathetic architect holds with his clients. He was privy to all their differences of opinion and all their disputes about the house. He knew just where to insist upon his own ideas, and where to yield. He was really building several other houses, but he gave the Laphams the impression that he was doing none but theirs. The work was not begun till the frost was thoroughly out of the ground, which that year was not before the end of April. Even then it did not proceed very rapidly. Lapham said they might as well take their time to it, if they got the walls up and the thing closed in before the snow flew, they could be working at it all winter. It was found necessary to dig for the kitchen, at that point the original salt marsh lay near the surface, and before they began to put in the piles for the foundation they had to pump. The neighborhood smelled like the hold of a ship after a 3 years' voyage. People who had cast their fortunes with the new land went by professing not to notice it, people who still hung onto the hill put their handkerchiefs to their noses, and told each other the old terrible stories of the material used in filling up the back bay. Nothing gave Lapham so much satisfaction in the whole construction of his house as the pile driving. When this began, early in the summer, he took Mrs. Lapham every day in his buggy and drove round to look at it, stopping the mare in front of the lot, and watching the operation with even keener interest than the little loafing Irish boys who superintended it in force. It pleased him to hear the portable engine chuckle out 100 thin whiffs of steam and carrying the big iron weight to the top of the framework above the pile, then seem to hesitate, and cough once or twice in pressing the weight against the detaching apparatus. There was a moment in which the weight had the effect of poising before it fell, then it dropped with a mighty whack on the iron-bound head of the pile, and drove it a foot into the earth. By gracious! He would say, there ain't anything like that in this world for business, Persis. Mrs. Lapham suffered him to enjoy the sight 20 or 30 times before she said, well, now drive on, see. By the time the foundation was in and the brick walls had begun to go up, there were so few people left in the neighborhood that she might indulge with impunity her husband's passion for having her clamber over the floor timbers and the skeleton staircases with him. Many of the householders had boarded up their front doors before the buds had begun to swell and the assessor to appear in early May, others had followed soon, and Mrs. Lapham was as safe from remark as if she had been in the depth of the country. Ordinarily she and her girls left town early in July, going to one of the hotels at Nantasket,
where it was convenient for the colonel to get to and from his business by the boat. But this summer they were all lingering a few weeks later, under the novel fascination of the new house, as they called it, as if there were no other in the world. Lapham drove there with his wife after he had set Bartley Hubbard down at the events office, but on this day something happened that interfered with the solid pleasure they usually took in going over the house. As the colonel turned from casting anchor at the mare's head with the hitching weight, after helping his wife to alight, he encountered a man to whom he could not help speaking, though the man seemed to share his hesitation if not his reluctance at the necessity. He was a tallish, thin man, with a dust-colored face, and a dead, clerical air, which somehow suggested at once feebleness and tenacity. Mrs. Lapham held out her hand to him. "Why, Mr. Rogers!" she exclaimed, and then, turning toward her husband, seemed to refer the two men to each other. They shook hands, but Lapham did not speak. "I didn't know you were in Boston," pursued Mrs. Lapham. "Is Mrs. Rogers with you?" "No," said Mr. Rogers, with a voice which had the flat, succinct sound of two pieces of wood clapped together. "Mrs. Rogers is still in Chicago." A little silence followed, and then Mrs. Lapham said, "I presume you are quite settled out there."
"No, we have left Chicago. Mrs. Rogers has merely remained to finish up a little packing."
"Oh, indeed. Are you coming back to Boston?"
"I cannot say as yet. We sometimes think of so doing."
Lapham turned away and looked up at the building. His wife pulled a little at her glove, as if embarrassed, or even pained. She tried to make a diversion.
"We are building a house," she said, with a meaningless laugh.
"Oh, indeed," said Mr. Rogers, looking up at it.
Then no one spoke again, and she said helplessly, "If you come to Boston, I hope I shall see Mrs. Rogers."
"She will be happy to have you call," said Mr. Rogers.
He touched his hat brim, and made a bow forward rather than in Mrs. Lapham's direction. She mounted the planking that led into the shelter of the bare brick walls, and her husband slowly followed. When she turned her face toward him, her cheeks were burning, and tears that looked hot stood in her eyes.
"You left it all to me," she cried. "Why couldn't you speak a word?"
"I hadn't anything to say to him," replied Lapham sullenly.
They stood a while, without looking at the work which they had come to enjoy, and without speaking to each other.
"I suppose we might as well go on," said Mrs. Lapham at last, as they returned to the buggy. The colonel drove recklessly toward the mill dam. His wife kept her veil down and her face turned from him. After a time she put her handkerchief up under her veil and wiped her eyes, and he set his teeth and squared his jaw.
"I don't see how he always manages to appear just at the moment when he seems to have gone fairly out of our lives, and blight everything," she whimpered.
"I supposed he was dead," said Lapham.
"Oh, don't say such a thing. It sounds as if you wished it.
Why do you mind it? What do you let him blight everything for?"
"I can't help it, and I don't believe I ever shall. I don't know as his being dead would help it any. I can't ever see him without feeling just as I did at first."
"I tell you," said Lapham, "it was a perfectly square thing. And I wish, once for all, you would quit bothering about it. My conscience is easy as far as he is concerned, and it always was. And I can't look at him without feeling as if you'd ruined him, Silas."
"Don't look at him, then," said her husband, with a scowl. "I want you should recollect in the first place, Persis, that I never wanted a partner. If he hadn't put his money in when he did, you'd a broken down."
"Well, he got his money out again, and more, too," said the colonel, with a sulky weariness.
"He didn't want to take it out. I gave him his choice, buy out or go out."
"You know he couldn't buy out then. It was no choice at all.
It was a business chance."
"No, you had better face the truth, Silas. It was no chance at all. You crowded him out. A man that had saved you.
No, you had got greedy, Silas. You had made your paint your god, and you couldn't bear to let anybody else share in its blessings.
I tell you he was a drag and a break on me from the word go. You say he saved me. Well, if I hadn't got him out he'd a ruined me sooner or later. So it's an even thing, as far forth as that goes."
"No, it ain't an even thing, and you know it, Silas. Oh, if I could only get you once to acknowledge that you did wrong about it, then I should have some hope. I don't say you meant wrong exactly, but you took an advantage.
Yes, you took an advantage. You had him where he couldn't help himself, and then you wouldn't show him any mercy."
"I'm sick of this," said Lapham. "If you'll tend to the house, I'll manage my business without your help."
"You were very glad of my help once."
"Well, I'm tired of it now. Don't meddle."
"I will meddle.
When I see you hardening yourself in a wrong thing, it's time for me to meddle, as you call it, and I will. I can't ever get you to own up the least bit about Rogers, and I feel as if it was hurting you all the while. What do you want I should own up about a thing for when I don't feel wrong? I tell you Rogers ain't got anything to complain of, and that's what I told you from the start. It's a thing that's done every day. I was loaded up with a partner that didn't know anything, and couldn't do anything, and I unloaded, that's all. You unloaded just at the time when you knew that your pain was going to be worth about twice what it ever had been, and you wanted all the advantage for yourself. I had a right to it. I made the success. Yes, you made it with Rogers's money, and when he'd made it you took his share of it. I guess you thought of that when you saw him, and that's why you couldn't look him in the face. At these words Lapham lost his temper. I guess you don't want to ride with me anymore today, he said, turning the mare abruptly round. I'm as ready to go back as what you are, replied his wife. And don't you ask me to go to that house with you anymore. You can sell it, for all me. I shan't live in it. There's blood on it. 4. The silken texture of the marriage tie bears a daily strain of wrong and insult to which no other human relation can be subjected without lesion, and sometimes the strength that knits society together might appear to the eye of faltering faith the curse of those immediately bound by it. Two people by no means reckless of each other's rights and feelings, but even tender of them for the most part, may tear at each other's heartstrings in this sacred bond with perfect impunity, though if they were any other two they would not speak or look at each other again after the outrages they exchange. It is certainly a curious spectacle, and doubtless it ought to convince an observer of the divinity of the institution. If the husband and wife are blunt, outspoken people like the Laphams, they do not weigh their words. If they are more refined, they weigh them very carefully, and know accurately just how far they will carry, and in what most sensitive spot they may be planted with most effect. Lapham was proud of his wife, and when he married her it had been a rise in life for him. For a while he stood in awe of his good fortune, but this could not last, and he simply remained supremely satisfied with it. The girl who had taught school with a clear head and a strong hand was not afraid of work, she encouraged and helped him from the first, and bore her full share of the common burden. She had health, and she did not worry his life out with peevish complaints and vagaries, she had sense and principle, and in their simple lot she did what was wise and right. Their marriage was hallowed by an early sorrow, they lost their boy, and it was years before they could look each other in the face and speak of him. No one gave up more than they when they gave up each other and Lapham went to the war. When he came back and began to work, her zeal and courage formed the spring of his enterprise. In that affair of the partnership she had tried to be his conscience, but perhaps she would have defended him if he had accused himself. It was one of those things in this life which seemed destined to await justice, or at least judgment, in the next. As he said, Lapham had dealt fairly by his partner in money, he had let Rogers take more money out of the business than he put into it, he had, as he said, simply forced out of it a timid and inefficient participant in advantages which he had created. But Lapham had not created them all. He had been dependent at one time on his partner's capital. It was a moment of terrible trial. Happy is the man forever after who can choose the ideal, the unselfish part in such an exigency. Lapham could not rise to it. He did what he could maintain to be perfectly fair. The wrong, if any, seemed to be condoned to him, except when from time to time his wife brought it up. Then all the questions stung and burned anew, and had to be reasoned out and put away once more. It seemed to have an inextinguishable vitality. It slept, but it did not die. His course did not shake Mrs. Lapham's faith in him. It astonished her at first, and it always grieved her that he could not see that he was acting solely in his own interest. But she found excuses for him, which at times she made reproaches. She vaguely perceived that his pain was something more than business to him, it was a sentiment, almost a passion. He could not share its management and its profit with another without a measure of self-sacrifice far beyond that which he must make with something less personal to him. It was the poetry of that nature, otherwise so intensely prosaic, and she understood this, and for the most part forbore. She knew him good and true and blameless in all his life, except for this wrong, if it were a wrong, and it was only when her nerves tingled intolerably with some chance renewal of the pain she had suffered, that she shared her anguish with him in true wifely fashion. With those two there was never anything like an explicit reconciliation. They simply ignored a quarrel, and Mrs. Lapham had only to say a few days after at breakfast, I guess the girls would like to go round with you this afternoon, and look at the new house, in order to make her husband grumble out as he looked down into his coffee cup. I guess we better all go, hadn't we? Well, I'll see, she said. There was not really a great deal to look at when Lapham arrived on the ground in his four-seated beach wagon. But the walls were up,
and the studding had already given skeleton shape to the interior. The floors were roughly boarded over, and the stairways were in place, with provisional treads rudely laid. They had not begun to lath and plaster yet, but the clean, fresh smell of the mortar in the walls mingling with the pungent fragrance of the pine shavings neutralized the Venetian odor that drew in over the water. It was pleasantly shady there, though for the matter of that the heat of the morning had all been washed out of the atmosphere by a tide of east wind setting in at noon, and the thrilling, delicious cool of a Boston summer afternoon bathed every nerve. The foreman went about with Mrs. Lapham, showing her where the doors were to be, but Lapham soon tired of this, and having found a pine stick of perfect grain, he abandoned himself to the pleasure of whittling it in what was to be the reception room, where he sat looking out on the street from what was to be the bay window. Here he was presently joined by his girls, who, after locating their own room on the water side above the music room, had no more wish to enter into details than their father. "Come and take a seat in the bay window, ladies," he called out to them, as they looked in at him through the ribs of the wall. He jocosely made room for them on the trestle on which he sat. They came gingerly and vaguely forward, as young ladies do when they wish not to seem to be going to do a thing they have made up their minds to do. When they had taken their places on their trestle, they could not help laughing with scorn, open and acceptable to their father, and Irene curled her chin up, in a little way she had, and said, "How ridiculous!" to her sister. "Well, I can tell you what," said the colonel, in fond enjoyment of their young ladyishness, "your mother wa'n't ashamed to sit with me on a trestle when I called her out to look at the first coat of my paint that I ever tried on a house."
"Yes, we've heard that story," said Penelope, with easy security of her father's liking what she said. "We were brought up on that story."
"Well, it's a good story," said her father. At that moment a young man came suddenly in range, who began to look up at the signs of building as he approached. He dropped his eyes in coming abreast of the bay window, where Lapham sat with his girls, and then his face lightened, and he took off his hat and bowed to Irene. She rose mechanically from the trestle, and her face lightened too. She was a very pretty figure of a girl, after our fashion of girls, round and slim and flexible, and her face was admirably regular. But her great beauty, and it was very great, was in her coloring. This was of an effect for which there is no word but delicious, as we use it of fruit or flowers. She had red hair, like her father in his earlier days, and the tints of her cheeks and temples were such as suggested mayflowers and apple blossoms and peaches. Instead of the gray that often dulls this complexion, her eyes were of a blue at once intense and tender, and they seemed to burn on what they looked at with a soft, lambent flame. It was well understood by her sister and mother that her eyes always expressed a great deal more than Irene ever thought or felt, but this is not saying that she was not a very sensible girl and very honest. The young man faltered perceptibly, and Irene came a little forward, and then there gushed from them both a smiling exchange of greeting, of which the sum was that he supposed she was out of town, and that she had not known that he had got back. A pause ensued, and flushing again in her uncertainty as to whether she ought or ought not to do it, she said, "My father, Mr. Corey, and my sister." The young man took off his hat again, showing his shapely head, with a line of wholesome sunburn ceasing where the recently and closely clipped hair began. He was dressed in a fine summer check, with a blue-white dotted neckerchief, and he had a white hat, in which he looked very well when he put it back on his head. His whole dress seemed very fresh and new, and in fact he had cast aside his Texan habiliments only the day before.
"How do you do, sir?" said the colonel, stepping to the window, and reaching out of it the hand which the young man advanced to take. "Won't you come in? We're at home here. House I'm building."
"Oh, indeed?" returned the young man, and he came promptly up the steps, and threw its ribs into the reception room.
"Have a trestle?" asked the colonel, while the girls exchanged little shocks of terror and amusement at the eyes.
"Thank you," said the young man simply, and sat down. "Mrs. Lapham is upstairs interviewing the carpenter, but she'll be down in a minute."
"I hope she's quite well," said Corey. "I supposed I was afraid she might be out of town."
"Well, we are off to Nantasket next week. The house kept us in town pretty late."
"It must be very exciting, building a house," said Corey to the elder sister.
"Yes, it is," she assented, loyally refusing in Irene's interest the opportunity of saying anything more.
Corey turned to the latter. "I suppose you've all helped to plan it?"
"Oh no, the architect and Mama did that. But they allowed the rest of us to agree, when we were good," said Penelope.
Corey looked at her, and saw that she was shorter than her sister, and had a dark complexion.
"It's very exciting," said Irene.
"Come up," said the colonel, rising, "and look round if you'd like to."
"I should like to, very much," said the young man.
He helped the young ladies over crevasses of carpentry and along narrow paths of planking, on which they had made their way unassisted before. The elder sister left the younger to profit solely by these offices as much as possible. She walked between them and her father, who went before, lecturing on each apartment, and taking the credit of the whole affair more and more as he talked on. "There," he said, "we're going to throw out a bay window here, so as get the water all the way up and down. This is my girl's room," he added, looking proudly at them both. It seemed terribly intimate. Irene blushed deeply and turned her head away. But the young man took it all, apparently, as simply as their father. "What a lovely lookout," he said. The back bay spread its glassy sheet before them, empty but for a few small boats and a large schooner, with her sails close furled and dripping like snow from her spars, which a tug was rapidly towing toward Cambridge. The carpentry of that city, embanked and embowered in foliage, shared the picturesqueness of Charlestown in the distance. "Yes," said Lapham, "I go in for using the best rooms in your house yourself. If people come to stay with you, they can put up with the second best. Though we don't intend to have any second best. There ain't going to be an unpleasant room in the whole house, from top to bottom." "Oh, I wish Papa wouldn't brag so," breathed Irene to her sister, where they stood, a little apart, looking away together. The colonel went on. "No, sir," he swelled out, "I have gone in for making a regular job of it. I've got the best architect in Boston, and I'm building a house to suit myself. And if money can do it, guess I'm going to be suited." "It seems very delightful," said Corey, "and very original." "Yes, sir. That fellow hadn't talked 5 minutes before I saw that he knew what he was about every time. I wish Mama would come," breathed Irene again. "I shall certainly go through the floor if Papa says anything more." "They are making a great many very pretty houses nowadays," said the young man. "It's very different from the old-fashioned building." "Well," said the colonel, with a large toleration of tone and a deep breath that expanded his ample chest, "we spend more on our houses nowadays. I started out to build a $40,000 house. Well, sir, that fellow has got me in for more than $60,000 already, and I doubt if I get out of it much under $100,000. You can't have a nice house for nothing. It's just like ordering a picture of a painter. You pay him enough, and he can afford to paint you a first-class picture, and if you don't, he can't. That's all there is of it. Why, they tell me that A.T. Stewart gave one of those French fellows $60,000 for a little 7x9 picture the other day. Yes, sir, give an architect money enough, and he'll give you a nice house every time." "I've heard that they're sharp at getting money to realize their ideas," assented the young man, with a laugh. "Well, I should say so," exclaimed the colonel. "They come to you with an improvement that you can't resist. It has good looks and common sense and everything in its favor, and it's like throwing money away to refuse. And they always manage to get you when your wife is around, and then you're helpless." The colonel himself set the example of laughing at this joke, and the young man joined him less obstreperously. The girls turned, and he said, "I don't think I ever saw this view to better advantage. It's surprising how well the Memorial Hall and the Cambridge spires work up, over there. And the sunsets must be magnificent." Lapham did not wait for them to reply. "Yes, sir, it's about the sightliest view I know of. I always did like the waterside of Beacon. Long before I owned property here, or ever expected to, wife and I used to ride down this way, and stop the buggy to get this view over the water. When people talk to me about the hill, I can understand them. It's snug, and it's old-fashioned, and it's where they've always lived. But when they talk about Commonwealth Avenue, I don't know what they mean. It don't hold a candle to the water side of Beacon. You've got just as much wind over there, and you've got just as much dust, and all the view you've got is the view across the street. No, sir. When you come to the back bay at all, give me the water side of Beacon." "Oh, I think you're quite right," said the young man. "The view here is everything." Irene looked, "I wonder what Papa is going to say next," at her sister, when their mother's voice was heard overhead, approaching the opening in the floor where the stairs were to be, and she presently appeared, with one substantial foot a long way ahead. She was followed by the carpenter, with his rule sticking out of his overalls pocket, and she was still talking to him about some measurements they had been taking, when they reached the bottom, so that Irene had to say, "Mama, Mr. Corey," before Mrs. Lapham was aware of him. He came forward with as much grace and speed as the uncertain footing would allow, and Mrs. Lapham gave him a stout squeeze of her comfortable hand. "Why, Mr. Corey, when did you get back?" "Yesterday. It hardly seems as if I had got back. I didn't expect to find you in a new house."
Well, you are a first caller. I presume you won't expect I should make excuses for the state you find it in. Has the colonel been doing the honors?
Oh yes. And I've seen more of your house than I ever shall again, I suppose.
Well, I hope not, said Lapham. There'll be several chances to see us in the old one yet, before we leave. He probably thought this a neat, offhand way of making the invitation, for he looked at his womankind as if he might expect their admiration.
Oh yes, indeed, said his wife. We shall be very glad to see Mr. Corey, any time.
Thank you, I shall be glad to come. He and the colonel went before, and helped the ladies down the difficult descent. Irene seemed less sure-footed than the others. She clung to the young man's hand an imperceptible moment longer than need be, or else he detained her. He found opportunity of saying, "It's so pleasant seeing you again," adding, "All of you."
"Thank you," said the girl. "They must all be glad to have you at home again."
Corey laughed.
"Well, I suppose they would be, if they were at home to have me. But the fact is, there's nobody in the house